Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Hello and welcome to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio, which comes to you to connect politics and finance, humanity and world peace, and the arts in a way that encourages all to think for themselves so the best political and life choices are made by all. With artistic overtones, the Reasonable Voice is an advocate for a peaceful and prosperous world filled with creativity and political unity. Today, my guests are from the Legislators of Tomorrow, Patrick McDonnell and Thomas Bunting. Patrick, why don't you say hello first so we know what you sound like?
Hello. Happy to be here.
And you, Thomas?
I am equally happy. I appreciate you taking your time to take us on.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Gentlemen, I guess we should, let's start with you, Thomas, and tell me how you two met and let's just go with that. How did you meet?
What a perfect question, Patrick. You're going to love this. So in the fall of 2012, we had a history class together. It was called, I think, U.S. Society from 1945. And one day, one glorious day, I might add, we had a discussion class in which Patrick came in, and I hadn't seen him before.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just waiting for the professor or whomever it was to start to question. And I can't remember exactly what happened, but all I remember is I think either Patrick might have said something, and then I, of course, came right back at him because I clearly disagree with what he said. And then that's just what happened from there. And then, since then, we became great friends.
Disagreement is the parent of a lot of great relationships, I have to say. Debate is healthy. So, Patrick, what do you remember of that experience?
I remember it being a very fun, little fiery at times, discussion back and forth, and I think we both came off with the conclusion that, my goodness, we definitely enjoyed it. And so I think that was the beginning to a wonderful friendship.
Fantastic. So did you start the legislators of Tomorrow, or is it an organization that existed that you joined? Either one of you, Patrick, Thomas.
Patrick and Jared were the originalists, if you want to call it that. But they were the ones who created it, and then they reached out to several. They had an email to listservs, and I wanted to be a part of that because I thought that was a great thing to be involved with and do the right thing.
So, Patrick, what is the Legislators of Tomorrow and their mission?
Legislators of Tomorrow really was created by, I was with another friend of mine, Jared Nagurka, a very active member of the University Democrats. I'm a very active member of the College Republicans, and we kind of came to the conclusion that there's a lot of politics out there. There's a lot of debate back and forth. There's a lot of tit for tat.
Mm-hmm.
However, there's very little governing that actually ends up getting done out of that.
Yeah.
And I think that should be the purpose of politics, and we came to the conclusion that we agreed on that, and that instead we should actually create an organization that got things done, in a bipartisan way.
Mm-hmm.
That's more or less how we came to the conclusion that we wanted to form Legislators of Tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And that led us to then send out an email, and Tom joined, and a number of other individuals joined as well.
Excellent. What's your membership now?
Our membership is about 13 committed members.
Fantastic.
Right now.
And both Democrats and Republicans?
Yes.
Very good. All right. Well, Thomas, I guess Patrick has sort of answered this, but let's take your take on it too. The mission of Legislators of Tomorrow is...
It is to get something done, or at least propose something that should not have a part of take on it, if you want to call it that.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, you know, you watch the General Assembly, and I actually interned with Delegate Toscano, and I watched some of the session videos, and then it seems to be the same thing. I mean, we see it in on the federal level as well, and all we see on with Fox and CNN, they want to play things that we want to see,
mm-hmm.
but the stuff that we need to be seeing. We need to see stuff getting done in a bipartisan fashion, and what Delegate Toscano says, oh, very often, many of the delegates say that we need to find a Virginia way and the solution to these things, and this is, the solution is when our Congress people, or our delegates work together. We don't send them there to bicker and fight. We send them there to get things done for the common good or commonwealth. So, and that's our microcosm is legislative tomorrow, and that's what we want to see. And that's why we came up with mental health, because that should not have any liberal-leaning or conservative-leaning That should not be a stolen partisan idea. It's just passing the House of Delegates passed it unanimously, and now it's on the Senate. So this is exactly why we chose this.
It's progress, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
Finally, on something I've always felt, and as some of my listeners might know, I have had to deal with mental illness with friends and family. I'll mention my mother and father because they're both gone now, but they both suffered from dementia, and of course we know we've State Senator Creed Deeds, a very tragic incident right. recently, and we'll get into all of that, but I want to spend some time talking about you, the two of you and the organization first. I like the whole bipartisan idea, and I like also that you defined Commonwealth. The reason it is, the Virginia was established as one of the three or four commonwealths in the nation is because that there is a slight difference in the way the government works, but there certainly is a focus and emphasis difference in that we start from day one saying this is for the good of everyone, and we certainly have gotten away from that, as you say, on both federal and many state levels. When there are issues, and I'd like to talk about a couple of other issues. We're going to get to mental health. I know that's your main focus. But can you talk to me, Patrick, say, what are, just for the sake of our feeling some sense of legislators of tomorrow and bipartisanship, the issues, since we have such extremes now in politics, what other issues can you identify, you know, two or three off the top of your head that you feel should, besides the easy answer of everything, of course, but what other issues specifically should conservatives and liberals and Democrats, Republicans, Libertarians, Tea Party, whatever, be able to address as common ground that affect us all? I mean, one certainly off the top of my head, obviously, is mental health. You are addressing that, but what about the safety of our water supply or minimum wage? And you tell me, Patrick and Thomas, what else? Just to sort of stimulate our audience into thinking how we can work together.
Look, I think that one of the points, Meg, you saw this kind of occur in the 1990s. Of course, that's when people on the federal level could still work together.
Yes.
Welfare is something that, you know, I think that both sides can certainly agree on. I think both sides understand that there are things that need to be done in that field. Now, we have disagreements on exactly what has to be done, but I think that that is something that we certainly could come together on and discuss and reform, because we understand that that's not something that is working. We also understand that the education system isn't working. Now, again, we have differing opinions on certain aspects of it, but I think that we both understand, A, that it's important, but B, that also, you know, teachers need to be paid more. Now, how we're going to do that, again, we're going to have, you know, discussions about, you know, how we're going to fund it. However, at the end of the day, I think that the vast majority of issues, mental health, education, welfare, three major issues that the country is facing, is something that Democrats and Republicans can actually talk about and have a solution to. Now, one of the problems is that, especially at the federal level, Democrats and Republicans barely talk with one another anymore. They have their own separate caucuses. They have their own separate breakfasts. They have their own separate lunches. And they never talk to one another, and they start believing all the anti... you can disagree with one another, disagree with one another's ideology, but understand that you can disagree without being disagreeable.
Exactly.
And they've forgotten that.
Yes.
And that's because they don't talk to one another, and all they see from the other side is the rhetoric.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't see that they're another human being and another person that they can negotiate with and work with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's why we haven't seen any significant change to these three major fields.
Yes.
Even though there's a great amount of potential in all three.
Mm. You know, I feel that I hear you because I can remember, not that it was all that long ago, as you said, it was in the 1990s, and certainly back in the days of Tip O'Neill, when members of Congress of both parties, as you say, they had a weekly prayer breakfast. They met for lunch. They had drinks after Congress. And a lot of the work of the next day and weeks came out of those kind of informal meetings, because as people and in a relaxed situation, they realized why they were there. But something has changed. Patrick, what do you think has changed? I know that's a huge question, but obviously, if we say we used to meet informally and discuss things and try to find common ground, and now we don't, that's a physical fact that has changed. But what caused it? How did we get here? It seems to me overnight, when you think in terms of political time. Patrick, anything?
Well, I would say that it started, I think, under, regrettably, I have to say that a Republican was one of the people who kind of spearheaded it. I think that Newt Gingrich started very much trying to gain party unity within the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, the Democrats copied that model. And the way that you gain unity is by being together all the time and by basically creating a clear leadership dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think that we still were working together during the Bush administration for a good amount of it, which leads me to believe that the real thing that has caused the major divisions that we face today are that the issues are so important that we're facing now. We're facing the Great Recession.
Yes.
And that brings a lot more partisan division. And I think that, you know, not to make a partisan swipe, but the passage of President Obama's Affordable Care Act did not help bipartisanship in any way. It was and I think that that's a good reason why the Tea Party came along, and the Tea Party perpetuated the cycle. It's all about it's basically a snowball effect that has occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, we're living with it. We're living with having made these poor decisions each point down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at some point we're going to have to say, this isn't working, and turn around and change something.
You know, I often say, Thomas, that it isn't. I mean, I know there certainly are extreme points of view in the general public. That's unmistakable. But I do feel that I used to say there was the 60-40. You know, the 20% on the left, 20% on the right were too extreme. But there's still that left of 60% of the people who were more or less moderate to the left or right of center, and they could talk to one another. I'm not certain that 60% is still intact, but I do feel there are more people, especially in universities, there are more people who are willing to talk to each other from a different point of view than there are in government who are willing to do the same, and that is definitely at the state level and the federal level. Do you think our communication problems or ability to work together are more in those who we elect as opposed to ourselves? In other words, is there as much division on the ground as there is in the seats of power? Thomas?
Well, I find that very funny to quote my favorite comic, George Carlin, in his 1996 comedy episode, I think in the Beacon Theater of New York City, asked, where do these politicians come from? They don't fall out of the sky.
Yes.
They come from American citizens. So, and I don't think that people don't want to
not talk to people, although it's very funny because if Patrick and I were walking down the street, it'd be very, it's almost funny at how quickly this conversation could break down, but at the end of the conversation, we realize we're just talking to one another, we're still friends, and we can still go get a non-alcoholic drink.
Yes.
Because we're almost at that age. What I think is on the federal level is people want that image, and the elected officials want that image to be like, they want those hot-button words, and that to me, and that's on both sides, I'm not just blaming either one.
Yes.
It's embarrassing because I didn't vote for, Jim Douglas last time, but he still lost, but, it's just embarrassing because the American people can do better, well, I hope, but...
Yes.
I do agree that the communication level on the ground at the universities is a little bit more open, except it's just not so much on the federal level, but I don't know why. I keep watching a few clips on, instead of studying, I watched Crossfire, and a few nights ago there was Senator Ted Cruz from Texas and Sheldon Whitehouse from Rhode Island, and then they just wouldn't even look at one another. You have Rhode Island, which is a liberal bastion, you also have Texas, which is a conservative bastion, and they... For some reason, your next election is based upon how you laugh or scold or scorn the other side. That's certainly not what Virginia does, but that's not what American people do. That's just not, or people in general, it's just not, you don't do that. That is unhealthy, I think. That is a mental health issue if you want to make it bad.
Exactly.
That needs to be solved.
Well, I certainly agree with that because I think that's my point. I am part of the media, but I watch the media, and again, it doesn't. There are those that are well known for just hyperbole, that's for sure. But even the ones that are respected as being more factual, it's still. I guess I won't mention any names, but because it's true on both sides to one degree or another. But my point is, even in the legitimate, if you will, media, mainstream media, it seems to be, we've gone from if it bleeds, it leads to this gotcha, we got to keep stoke the flames. So not that I'm apologizing for elected officials who are not working with one another, I certainly am not, and I'm not apologizing for the people or excusing the people who elect those people, but I do think the media plays a role in churning the fire and keeping it going, and I hate to think that's just about... we want to be popular on TV because if I'm close to being right and say 50% of the people out in the hinterlands don't want a gridlocked government at state or federal level, then who are the media and these politicians playing to? Patrick, what do you think?
Well, I think that to a certain extent, one of the main reasons why we have the issue that we have, I'm going to partially answer, I think, the question that you asked Thomas just a little bit differently.
Okay.
I think that the way that the partisan sides work is, first of all, we do have in Congress, specifically the House, a redistricting type tactic.
Yes.
In which you deal with more extreme individuals in basically every district. Now, the reason why we elect more partisan or extreme individuals is because they're closer to our particular ideology and we want our way all the time.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think that, and people have been made to believe that they can have that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's been a change in the American public. I think that the American public used to understand that you have to work together.
Yes.
That you can't have everything. Because the only way that you get everything that you want all the time is if you're the person in charge of the country with no one else being able to talk, and that's basically a one-person dictatorship, and that's not what we have. We have a system in which we have to work together. Now, I think that the media certainly has played a role. I think it goes a little bit deeper than that. I think that the Great Recession, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have brought to light very divisive issues that people disagree about thoroughly. And that when you have divisive issues, you're going to be dealing with more divisive individuals
mm-hmm.
who are going to play to the crowd. Now, I think that it is, to a certain extent, the media's fault, but I think that the media is a bit of a punching bag now and again.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is the responsibility of the American people
yes.
to decide we're going to elect moderates, we're going to elect people who can get things done. I'm not saying that you shouldn't elect someone you agree with. I'm saying that you should elect someone you agree with who can still act.
Yes.
William F. Buckley argued that you should elect the most conservative person who could win, but also somebody who could govern.
Yes.
And I think that that's been something lost on both sides. It's now just smash the other side,
yeah.
beat them, humiliate them. And at the end of the day, that doesn't work.
Exactly. All right, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about specifics in HB 206, also a tragedy that we have experienced recently here in the Commonwealth of Virginia. The Reasonable Voice is in the studio with me today. In addition to my guests, our technical support, creative catalyst and spoken word poet, Mr. Bernard Hankins, with Michelle Opperman and Daniel L. Garner, the literary duo and philosophical minds who created O.G. Rose. And we're going to take a moment now to hear from one of our sponsors. And stay with us. We'll be right back with Patrick McDonald and Thomas Bunting of Legislators of Tomorrow.
Women get paid less than men because men get laid less than women. Unequal paychecks are men's method of payback because men picked up the checks on dates, but in the end, women didn't lay on their backs. Withholding sex leads to withholdings in checks. The top of the corporate ladder is a boardroom table, but the bottom is a bedroom headboard and a dinner table. The dollar is the basis for the macrocosm, and economic microcosm is orgasm. You are the woman who I took out to dinner and paid for. And now you want a raise? I already paid you when I paid for you. You turned me down for sex, didn't offer me your company. So now I'll get to turn down your offer to buy your company. You rejected my proposal, so now I'll reject your project proposal. Because this is business. And I can, because this is business run by a man. I never got any gratification or even gratitude for my 15% gratuity. So I compensated myself double that, 30 cents on the dollar in comparison to you to me.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voices Blog Talk Radio. My guests today are from the Legislators of Tomorrow, and I don't know if we mentioned in the last segment that that's at least sort of makes a home base at the University of Virginia. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Very good. And my guests today are Patrick McDonald and Thomas Bunting, who are members of the Legislators of Tomorrow, Patrick being one of the founding members, as a matter of fact. Now, tell us... I know what HB 206 is, but let's educate everybody. First of all, what does HB stand for?
House Bill.
House Bill. Okay. And 206, House Bill 206 is about what, and what are your feelings about it being passed?
The title of the bill, I'm looking at it on LIS, but I love that website. We're all, every single bill and Senate House bill and resolutions on that website.
Yes.
Phenomenal resource. It is the Higher Education Institution's four-year mental health resources available to students on website. That's what it was cut down to. We had far more in it, but it was essentially, in my view, it was kind of gutted, but we still got a very key element here.
Uh-huh.
But aside from that, you gotta work with what you got, so that's what we have.
Yes. So what is HB 206?
It's a mental health awareness bill that basically is looking at the fact that at colleges and universities across the state,
mm-hmm.
We actually have relatively good mental health resources.
Mm-hmm.
However, the issue that we're facing is that no one knows about them.
Yes.
And really, no one knows about the good resources available. They might as well be bad resources
mm-hmm.
because they're not being utilized. And so what we decided to try to address is the fact that nobody knows about them. for trying to fix that particular problem. We're trying to make sure that people do know about it. And one very important part of that is by making it part of the main website on the main website by the university or college.
Yes,
to have that available to the student to see when they're looking to, you know, go to their classes, that they can see, oh, there's mental health resources available right here, and if I need help, I know where to get it. And that was the major thing that we had in our bill, and we're very happy to see that it's still in there. And that it just passed 99-0 in the Virginia House delegates, and, you know, it looks like that very well might become law. I think that that would very much improve the mental health awareness at colleges and universities.
Well, I have to say I was quite pleased and proud to be able to report that in the news, that it had indeed passed unanimously. I know Senator Craig Deeds and have interviewed him a number of times, and I also know that he's not just for this because of his personal tragedy, but because we have, again, I speak from personal experience, having been told by a number of, well, let's put it this way. I had a career in New York, and all of a sudden I hear from relatives that my parents are not doing well, and they don't know why, because there were no mental health professionals in the family. Anyway, so I go back, and really, to tell you the truth, in those early stages of Alzheimer's, which is just one form of mental illness, because I knew them, my parents, so well, I could detect little signs, and then I became, not necessarily by choice, but by self-educating as time went on, a person who knew how to deal with the mental decline in an elderly person. Now, as I said, as you know, that's only one mental illness. There's schizophrenia. There's so many. How do we get on a university website, which I know is your primary goal? You say you have the resources, but how do you break that down? Do you do that on a website, or is there a one link you go to, and is that the goal, to find out, okay, what is my particular issue, and how do you get students who have a mental illness issue, how do you get them to, I mean, there's still a stigma with that, no matter, I mean, here we are in the 2014, and there's still a stigma about mental health. Go right ahead. Who's talking to me?
I'll go first, Tom. Can
okay.
what I would say to address one question at a time, I think that at the end of the day, somebody suffering with depression really wants to get help.
Yes.
And is there a stigma? Yes. And is that truly unfortunate? Yes. However, I think that even with that stigma, which I believe should be addressed and should be fixed, but even with that, I think that the instinct to try to help yourself and to get help and to try to fix what you're dealing with will overcome that. And if you know where to go, you will go out there and you will reach out to try to get help. I think that this on its own, the website will do a great deal. I don't think that it's the end-all be-all.
Mm-hmm.
There is a few additional things that we had in the bill that we are certainly going to pursue again.
Mm-hmm.
To try to increase awareness and to fight the stigma that is at colleges and universities. However, the step to having that link on the website, which will have all the resources available, the phone numbers, the office hours, and everything else, I think will make a difference. And I think that it's the first step in the right direction.
I agree. One solution. It will take a series of steps that get us where we need to be. But the first step is to give an opportunity, a resource, an open door at which one can knock, and discretion privacy, so that people will come forth. I think that's all important. we know that for Senator Deeds, again, it was tragic, and perhaps not everyone knows this story, so we should speak about the specifics of that a bit. Gus, the senator's son, was certainly suffering from depression and attacked his father, and was not successful in he certainly hurt his father, he cut him and all that, but as a result, when the senator was able to get away to get help, in the meantime, his son Gus committed suicide. And there's a real push to, you know, finger point that the problem was there wasn't a bed available for the senator's son, and the 24-hour rule now trying to change that to... Do you think, because that, of course, is a resource, can we approach that specific incident and discuss how your bill and more that you want in your bill, for that matter? I'd like to hear about what you'd like to have added that was not included. How, using the specific Deeds tragedy as an example, how would what you're doing as the legislators of tomorrow would have changed things or helped? Is there a way?
Sure. Absolutely. What we are trying to do with this particular bill, there would have been resources available to Gustave when he was at William & Mary, I believe, yes.
Yes.
At William & Mary. William & Mary will be one of the universities that is affected by the bill because it is a public university.
Mm-hmm.
I think that to try to simply deal with these cases is perhaps a mistake. Because I think that we actually proposed this bill before the Creedy's tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's unfortunate that the only way that this has come to our attention,
yes,
is such a public, horrible tragedy.
Yes.
That has to be what shocks this into our collective consciousness.
Yes.
But to address also one of your other points about the what do we want to add into the bill,
mm-hmm.
we were looking to do an online module at the University of Virginia and a number of other universities in the state. They have alcohol modules, which you are quizzed on a number of facts. You read over a number of facts, and then you're quizzed on it.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, you're trying to learn more about alcohol, how to deal with it,
mm-hmm.
how to deal with, you know, if a friend has drank too much and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And that has actually had a very large effect on the student populations of those universities.
Mm.
Larger awareness, greater safety. Now, we believe that if you're going to put alcohol at that prominent, as so prominently important, you certainly should put mental health at similar, if not greater, importance.
Yes.
Because by multiple studies, college students die more due to mental health illnesses than by alcohol.
Wow.
And I think that the fact that we didn't address that, we weren't able to, was a failure on our part. However, we will be trying to go back, trying to make sure that that's re-included into the bill.
Mm-hmm.
Push through as a separate bill. Also, there was reform to the RA system. I think that another issue is that, you know, the RAs don't have a conversation with the students.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about alcohol again. They have this conversation about alcohol. They have conversation about noise in the hallway. But they don't have the conversation about one of the things that kill the largest number of college students.
And when you say RAs, right, tell us what that means.
Resident advisors,
gotcha,
who are basically the people on the halls in dorms at colleges and universities.
Mm-hmm. And so, as you say, they'll talk about alcohol, but they do not talk about mental illness issues.
No, they do not.
Wow. Well,
certainly no one within the organization of over 13, we went around the room. Who knew what the mental health resources were at University of Virginia, which, by the way, has a very, has one of the more effective public affairs type of network to get mental health awareness to its students. We went around the room with 14 students, and no one knew. No one had had that conversation with their RAs, and no one had knowledge of how to get mental health to the mental health resources at the University of Virginia. That's one of the ways that we know that there is an issue where 14 informed students don't have any idea of where to go or who to talk to.
Well, obviously, I mean, that leaves me speechless. So how do you change that? Because that is a that's not necessarily something that the General Assembly would address. Correct me if I'm wrong, but certainly each university, I mean, Virginia Tech comes to mind, of course, as well. Where there is the most direct contact outside of the classroom, there needs to be, obviously, an open-door policy where if the RA sees something you need to ask about, or if the student has a need to talk to someone, it would seem to me. Now, the RA is not a medical professional, I'm presuming, but at least a conversation could first of all give some degree of comfort that to the student that I have a place to go, but also the RA would then be in a position to speak to medical professionals. Yes, or is that too much of an invasion of privacy? Where do the legislators of tomorrow stand on that?
No, I think you're absolutely right, because a resident advisor is there for you.
Yeah.
Well, I tried the UVA, but I did not have one.
Uh-huh.
However, a resident advisor should be somebody you should feel comfortable with going to. I mean, if you're not comfortable with that and you have a problem, you're going to keep it to yourself, and it's not going to not going to be solved like that.
Exactly.
And so if you have a friend that is a resident advisor, at least if you can talk about it, that should at least calm it down somewhat and be able to feel comfortable and be like, okay, I need to talk about this. How do I go about solving it? What do I need to do? And that is the first step to recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the policy is already in place with resident advisors at colleges and universities. Once they realize that there is some form of a problem, I think is actually relatively effective. And I don't think that that's particularly something that we have to address.
Uh-huh.
And I think that it actually quite possibly would be an overreach if we attempted to have the state regulate something like that.
Exactly.
Such a micromanaging of the university.
And I agree with that, which begs the question then, and perhaps your organization's mission is already answering that, and that is, how does the administration of universities, without the imposition of state government or federal government, it may be that we've come right to the point of the very raison d'etre of your organization. Once they are made to realize, hey, mental illness needs to be talked about and discussed, and there needs to be a resource where people can vent. And perhaps in through the venting discover just the degree of their need for professional attention, but that nobody, I hate to oversimplify, but nobody has thought, oh, that's a problem, until you guys come along, at least not enough to make a national statement or even a statewide statement. So how is the Sullivan administration responding to your organization? You've been on television lately, so she's got to be aware of it.
The Sullivan administration has been very supportive up to this point. She has been very positive about the bill. She was for the bill in its original form.
Good for her.
So, as a general matter, I think that the Sullivan administration has been very positive, not something that we would complain about, certainly. I think that there are certain things that, you know, the Sullivan administration could do to further address mental health awareness at colleges and universities. However, I think that she's been very cooperative so far, and we are very appreciative of what she's done for us.
And I should say for our listeners that we're talking about the first woman president of the University of Virginia, Teresa Sullivan, who I found to be a very positive influence on the university as an outsider media person looking, and she has certainly been through her own challenges at the university just to remain the president, and spoke very well of her that faculty, Senate, and students made their voices heard to keep her as president, and I'm glad and not surprised to hear that she is being supportive. We can all do more, and maybe we've reached a point in this interview where we need to get a couple of those websites that you've mentioned where people can go to be supportive, or even perhaps, are you open to more members of Legislators of Tomorrow? Do you have to be a student or a grad of UVA?
At this moment, we are specifically University of Virginia student organization. Mm-hmm. However, we certainly are considering growing the organization to try to make a bigger influence. But at this point, it is only University of Virginia students.
Okay, and how then can those listening be of help or support, or what can they? What do you need from us?
Well, we are currently the House Bill 206 is going to be in the state Senate very soon,
mm-hmm.
And we would greatly appreciate it if you called your state senators. And I think that calling delegates about the issue of mental health couldn't hurt either. Get it into their heads. Make it important to them. You know, it's interesting being students who, you know, have been pushing this particular bill, that you feel a little helpless at times when you're dealing with government.
Mm-hmm.
You think you're too small to make a difference.
Mm.
But the fact is that 14 students have pushed a mental health bill through the Virginia House of Delegates.
Excellent.
You're not too small.
Exactly.
You're not too small. You can make a difference, and calling delegates, actually, we have found, makes a difference for them. They do think about it. They do talk about it.
And I'd like
calling
to
them.
Go ahead, sorry. And I'd like to reiterate that, and hope that all listening will do that. Pick up the phone. I've worked with certain progressive groups in as a lobbyist for Congress. And I've been told by congressmen and women that, you know, short of showing up yourself, a telephone call does a lot more than email or clicking an online petition. When you get their office on the phone, and even if you don't get the member, you get an assistant, you get someone who will pass along the message, and they do. And the volume of calls is a definite influence and has an impact. And as our guests today, Patrick and Thomas, have proven, it doesn't take a large number, but it takes numbers. It takes repetition. It takes, look at the 2012 election. I mean, an awful lot of people came out and said, well, no, we don't, despite all the money that's being spent in opposition of a certain point of view, we want this point of view. So people do make the difference. I'm afraid we're going to have to close with that. Patrick and Thomas, Patrick McDonald and Thomas Bunting of Legislators of Tomorrow of the University of Virginia, who have just successfully gotten House Bill 206 through the House of Delegates in the General Assembly in Richmond, Virginia. And that's not a small accomplishment. It's on to the state Senate, and we encourage university, college, community college, and the general public to be supportive of these in whatever state you live. Thank you so much, Patrick and Thomas, for being on the show today. I greatly appreciate it.
Our pleasure.
All right. Bye now, and we'll be for sure we'll be talking again.
Look forward to it.
Now, don't go away, anyone. Stick with us. We've had a wonderful conversation today. We're going to continue with a panel discussion with Mr. Bernard Hankins, Michelle Opperman, and Daniel L. Garner, the reasonable voices in the studio today. Thank you, and goodbye to our guests, but everyone else, stay with us.
From dinner table to boardroom table, I've turned the tables. I picked up the bill, put down a tip, left money on the table. With this deal, I'm not leaving any money on the table. And I'm not leaving sex on the table. Non-negotiable, we're not closing the deal until we're having sex on the table. So it's fine if you want to make sex a currency, you can win in the social context. But once you step into my office, you're on my terms. You want money, I want sex. Not until we've slept. Every butt slap, every sexually suggestive line, taking back piece by piece what should have been mine the whole time. You can make complaints about my compliments until I am compliant. You can make me a plaintiff, but I'll remain complicit and defiant. This is payback for all the dinners I bought and you never paid me back. Grope by grope on your chest, or dime by dime deducted from every woman's check until the total amount of every meal bought for a woman is replaced in my account. Cent by red cent until the balance reads a zero. Only then will we be even. Only then will we be equal.
Welcome back to our panel discussion. This is The Reasonable Voices. And by the way, The Reasonable Voices in the studio with me today are technical support, creative catalyst, and spoken word poet, Mr. Bernard Hankins, with Michelle Opperman and Daniel L. Garner, the literary duo and philosophical minds who created O.G. Rose. Thanks for joining us for our show today and for our panel discussion. I'm Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice. And, you know, we hear a lot of things about polls saying, you know, is the country going in the right direction? And I just cannot get over how people, yes, the country's going in the wrong direction, and what does that mean? Right direction, wrong direction, what does it mean? But mostly, I would like to talk today about this whole, you know, this billionaire and his Nazi thing kind of makes me think of it, because that was a stupid thing to say. That's not really the issue we need to discuss. But we keep throwing out 99%, and where it's 98% and 2%, then it's 99% and 1%. Now it's the top 1% of the 1%, and you're going, but you have to know there are people like Buffett and Bill Gates in there who do wonderful things for people. And as Bernard has said in the past on other panels, we are guaranteed, well, on paper anyway, the pursuit of happiness, and we're guaranteed equal opportunity to be successful, but nobody guaranteed you that you would be Bill Gates. So all that to say, but my major point I'd like us to discuss is, who the heck are the 99%? Do you really think they're all raving lunatics who vote Democrat, you know, for Democrats? The 99%, by any definition, is a whole lot of people. Men, women, children, all colors, shapes, sizes, ages, and some of them like to shoot things, and some of them abhor guns, and some of them vote for Republicans, some for Tea Party people, some for Democrats, some for, what's Rand Paul?
Libertarian.
So I think we need to look at what unites us, not because I think all rich people are bad, but I do think there are some CEOs and FEOs and board members on certain banks and corporations that are American only in name. And I think we should look at our lives and say, okay, what can we do together, regardless of who we elect to Congress or the White House? What can we do together? What unites us most these days, talking about economy, what unites us most? What are we for? What are we against?
Well, I think, you know, just talking about 99, first of all, it's built into the language, like the 99 versus.
Yes.
And the same thing, you can bring that up with women and men. It's always presented as like men versus women, the battle of the sexes.
Yeah.
So already in the language itself, we've created the fact that we're supposed to be in opposition mm-hmm. to one another, depending on who you side with. Secondly, I think it gets to the human desire to belong. Everybody wants to belong to some sort of group. You know, everybody's rooting for their football team with Super Bowl coming up. Mm. And so you're gonna unite with people who you most closely more identify with, obviously have similar values. So I think that's the first thing. It's easy to fall into a group just because you want to belong. Mm. But then secondly, it's much easier to fall into a group with a lot more people. Mm. So if you are the 99%, there's obviously 99 of you, you know, proportionally speaking, and one of them. Mm. And so you have more voices, and so you feel more connected, and you feel more heard. And then on top of that, in our culture, you know, we root for the underdog. Mm. So if you associate 99 with those who don't always do as well, you kind of create a safety for yourself as well. Because who's going to pick on, you know, it's easy to pick on Nazis. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to defend a Nazi.
Yes, exactly.
You can say anything you want about a Nazi and no one will get mad at you because they are the enemy. Mm-hmm. So obviously if you're the person who would pick on the Jewish people, you're going to be the one in trouble because yes. you're bringing more pain on someone who's already had pain.
Yes.
So I think it all goes back to belonging and wanting a sense of identity. And that's why I think, you know, my topic that I talk to everybody about is you don't want to find your identity in a political group or a football team or your job, because you're ultimately going to, when that fails, then your identity fails.
Well, see, that speaks exactly to my question that I'd like us to try and answer, or give our opinions anyway. The 99% are not just one political party,
right,
by any means, or one sex or one race or one economic. Well, they may be. Well, they're not even one economic thing, because plenty of people, 99%, are millionaires. So why is it we say this 99%, as Bernard is saying, as though we're a united front, but we're anything but?
Well, I think thinking about the 99% and the 1%, when you were talking, Marcello, earlier, I was just thinking about how if somebody's in the 99% and there's the 1% who, in the general consensus of what those terms mean, has more money, you know, has a lot more money, wouldn't you want to befriend them? I mean, wouldn't you want to, like, say, you know, if you would like them to be equitable with what they earn, wouldn't you want to befriend them instead? You know, instead of say, like, you're a horrible person, you're the 99, you're the 1%, and you're hoarding everything, da-da-da-da. You know, because I think it's in human nature to kind of look out for oneself and want to keep what they earn and not share it necessarily. But I think we can learn how to share it if we actually take the route of teamwork versus like having a them versus us type of divide. The other thing I was going to say is this whole conversation of the 1% and their 99% reminds me of something Bernard said in another panel discussion we had, where he talks about, like, when we're talking about laws, like, you know, you can create laws for things, but it doesn't change the mindset necessarily. Like, you could create more equal pay for women, but a boss can be resentful to have to, you know, enact that law in their business. So, like, with the 1% and the 99%, I feel as though you're just, you know, you can't. To want the 1% to share their wealth is a, you know, I think that's a good idea, you know, for people to share what they have, right? But, like, that's not just the 1% that should do that. That's everybody, mm-hmm. right? And then another thing, too, is you can't just make, to be antagonistic is the wrong route to encourage a person who has more goods to share or have more money to share that money. And if you just stamp, you know, make people do that with the law, which arguably is a little bit like taxes, you know, we can get into that maybe, but like a tax on the rich. You know, if you do that, it doesn't necessarily make people want to share their money. Mm-hmm. So if anything, it would make them feel mad about it and possibly even protest it and possibly even, you know, cause regulation to be created that would make them not have to share what they've earned themselves or what, even if that's, they've earned it in a rightful way or, you know, a good way or in a possibly underhanded way. Hopefully it's, you know, in a right way.
You know, I think that's not, in my opinion, a chicken, which came first, the chicken or the egg. I think the problem was created on Wall Street and with a government that was sympathetic and empathetic to that point of view. I think, like my nemesis Mitt Romney, I agree on one thing with him, and that is that corporations are people. And we need to stop thinking of them as buildings of granite and brick and smoked windows. There are people in there, and there are people making decisions. And some of them are choosing to work in middle-class positions because they're supporting their family. And some of them are in higher floors in closed-off rooms and floors. I mean, that are making decisions that are about very few people profiting. So I don't know. I mean, I was once rich, comparatively, not like the 1%, but I made a lot of money. I had several homes, and I lived in a beautiful place in New York City and had a home out on Shelter Island, if you please, which is even better than Long Island, all that stuff. But I don't think most people are asking rich people to give them money or to even share their money. I think most people within the 99% are saying, as a matter of fact, I've seen these signs on TV, we don't have anything against your being rich. We are against your keeping us poor. I think it is about control and power that is the issue. And of course, yes, taxes. Everyone should pay their fair taxes, percentage of taxes, and Buffett's secretary shouldn't be paying a higher percent than he is in taxes. Yes, taxes are part of the thing. But I don't. But if there is a class war, an economic class war, it did not start with the 99% making war against the 1%. It was the other way around. That's my opinion.
Well, a bird needs a right wing and a left wing to fly. But just because it has both doesn't mean it will.
Mm-hmm.
Second, 1% is an income class. 99% is an income class. It is therefore possible for a 99% to move into the 1% and for the 1% to move into the 99%. Mm. My problem with that categorization is there will always be a 1% and there will always be a 99% because you can break up any amount of wealth. You could find a 48% versus blah, blah, percent, et cetera, et cetera. The question is there movement between these income brackets? Are people in the, if the 50% moving into the other 50% and vice? And what we do see now is, unfortunately, a gradual slowing up of the movement between economic classes, which can be everything from the lower 10% percentile to the upper 90 percentile. Well, people aren't moving out of the lower 10 to the 90. Well, that's an issue. The problem is we've lost economic mobility, which is a myriad of reasons that we can get into. Second, if I'm not mistaken, the total amount of money in circulation is, I think, $18 trillion. I think there's $15 trillion in credit, and there's $3 trillion in actual paper money. I can be totally wrong. I'm not completely sure. Well, the richest person, I think, in America is either Bill Gates or Warren Buffett, and they have below $100 billion. It's like $50 billion, something like that, or 32, maybe not even that much. Well, hold on. If 99% of the wealth is contained in the 1% use, that's... Well, I understand 1% control the majority of the wealth. But the total amount of wealth in circulation is in the trillions. But none of these super rich people have over $1 trillion. Where is the wealth? It's contained in the banks. And what's kind of weird is it doesn't seem as if the super rich people who are super rich, comparatively speaking, if you have $1 billion or $2 billion, don't actually have that trillion. It seems to be contained in the system.
Okay.
So what, if anything, that needs to be happening is the 99 percentile, which I think they're wrong to target the rich 1%.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, they should be targeting the 1% of the system that contains 99% of the wealth and demanding for that wealth to be broken up, which now how one goes about doing that actually requires a little bit of pain economically for the system because, it has to be transformed. If we as a people are willing to go through that, which I think we should be because we all benefit in the end, then we can fix this problem. But to go on to your point, Marcello, the 99% is made up of right and left. And that is the potential for unity. I think a lot of people in the right confuse the distinction between being pro-business and pro-free enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big difference. But again, a lot of people in the left confuse pro-business with pro-free enterprise. I'm not pro-business. I'm pro-free enterprise. I'm all about the freedom of businesses. And any business that stands against free enterprise would be done away with. It's uncapitalistic. Something Milton Friedman said that just his name will enrage quite a few people, but I think he said something very profound that to me actually is perhaps a point where the right and the left can begin unifying. Someone asked him if he was pro-business, and he said, no, I'm not pro-business at all. I'm pro-free enterprise. And the reason I don't want big government isn't because I dislike government, is because I believe it will inevitably be corrupted by business. And I thought that was profound, because he says, I'm not against government, I'm against business. And I just think that if you grow government, inevitably you'll have lobbying, inevitably you'll have the corruption. And whether or not you agree with that or not is a different question, but that's the kind of nuanced thinking, that synthetic thinking that I think we need more of in the country. That's not a purely left nor a purely right position, but it's a bird with a right and left wing that can help us all fly.
But you do need the body between the wings to get that. I don't think corruption is inevitable. I do disagree with that, but I do agree when people say for instance, Republicans are the party of business and Democrats are the party of the rest of the people, I guess. Business is not just if you are a party that favors the big business as opposed to the small business and entrepreneurs or whatever, you can say all day I'm for business, but again it comes back to whoever the people are in the 99%, they are everybody, and they need to think about how do we work together to say, okay, what are we doing to ourselves? What are we allowing to have happen? Because as you say, and I don't want to quote it either, but I have done a couple of videos on it, and I'm trying to remember. I think the numbers you're looking for, Daniel, are we are a $15 trillion economy in $3 trillion worth of debt. So the question is, where is this big economic problem? And that's where Daniel has really hit it, even though I think he flipped his numbers, but still, that's the point. It isn't that individuals who have billions of dollars, it's banking institutions that are holding on to not only real trillions, but promised made-up trillions, and are not using it to stimulate the economy. Why isn't the 99% standing together and saying in this far and no further?
Well, I mean, I think it could be easy just to focus merely on the financial framework, but I'm always interested in the underlying human framework. Mm-hmm. So, first thing is there's this preacher, Joseph Prince. He said something interesting. He said, there's a lot of rich people who are generous.
Yes.
And there's some poor people who are really stingy.
Mm-hmm.
So you can paint, rich people as hoarding up money. You can paint poor people as giving. It's like, but I guarantee you can find a homeless person who might find a bunch of jackets and want to keep it all to himself. And you can find somebody like a Bill Gates who's now spending money trying to come up with, cures for diseases. So I think this gets back to what we talk about a lot, is like seeing people face to face. Like if we talk about unity, we can't just watch a TV show, read a book, read an article and say, the 99% of 1%, because you're never going to get to know that person. You're going to get to know that, caricature. So it makes me think of, something I always talk about, which is, you can both sides, that's the problem again, is these sides. You can start to create these psychological things in your mind. Like, it's easy to say, rich people have sort of removed themselves from society. When in one sense, we all agree with that sentiment. Because what did all the movies show? Once somebody gets some money, the next scene, they're in the car, and then they're shopping, on Saks Fifth Avenue, and then they're going back to the neighborhood. See you guys, I'm moving on up. So there's this idea that once you become rich, you want to move away from everyone else. Mm-hmm. But I think the perception can be that, these people think they're better. And it's like, no, you, in one sense, have that same narrative of once I get this, then I'm moving on up.
Yeah.
So you can forget that while you may be in a certain category, you too have been taught to hate these people until you become one of them, which creates, a lot of confusion because you're thinking to yourself, I hate these people, yet I also want to be one of them, and I want what they have.
And that's part of the political problem, where the will is lacking politically, although I think there's money changing hands too, but where the will is lacking politically is that there are a lot of Americans who believe and expect that they will become wealthy, and they don't want things, taxes or other things, imposed or limitations or government regulation or control on the wealthy, because one day, as Bernard's saying, they expect and hope to be there, and they don't want to have to put up with that.
It's easy for me to look at you. If you were a person who I dislike, Marshall, I'm like, he's got money, I don't like it, you should give me your money.
Yeah.
If we switch shoes and you say, give me your money, Bernard, and I'd be like, all of
are
a sudden
you out of
I realized,
your mind?
Why? Like, even if I didn't earn it, if it was inherited, whatever, I would be like, why do I owe you money? Like, you have to really put yourself in someone else's shoes to realize what they're thinking, because you might think the same thing.
I don't speak for the 99%, but I don't believe that most of the 99%, which includes everyone of every political and economic persuasion, I don't think they're asking to be given the money of the rich. I'm not asking for their money. I'm asking not the rich per se. I'm asking the institutions made up by a small number of wealthy people who are making decisions that are not best for America, but rather best for them, who are already looking to China and other markets because they feel America is in economic decline, a decline, by the way, which they stimulated.
Yeah, well, I mean, it just makes me think about how, well, okay, let me say it in a way that doesn't sound so crazy, radical, or whatever, but it's almost like the 99% should really be, I mean, we talked about it a little bit already, but it's like, you should really be talking to the government, not this hype, this idea of the 1%. You know what I mean? The government and corporations are the ones who are very, very, very connected. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, a Democratic, you know, we have a Democratic president who's rather socialistic. And we, you know, it's, I mean, even that idea of we don't want to be for business, which usually Democrats are linked with, there's still a huge connection with corporatism, especially when it comes to bailing out certain companies. And that's in goodwill, right? And yet it's at the same time fueling the very thing that, you know, perhaps a very Democratic position is usually on the bandwagon for. So, I think the 99%, if anything, should really be talking to the government and corporations. Once again, not just buildings, and because there are people in there, right? But it's really the people who have the influence, the power, right? It's not just the money, but the power, or are really only given that power also because of governments. You know, kind of exchange of authority or sort of a extension of authority, you know? So, I don't know. I think that instead of just, and I think at the end of the day, I think, I don't want to say that it's just a silly discussion to talk, you know, to be part of the one, or the 99%, but it's just, it's so abstracted from people, you know, and from people you can, to Bernard's point, right, just to be face-to-face. So, anyways.
Well, too, there should be equal people on Wall Street and equal people in D.C., because the line where one ends and the other begins is gone. That's the problem. Yes. You know, the reason Freeman said it was inevitable, because he said the businesses will use their money to corrupt government.
And
I think
they have.
And whether or not that's inevitable or not, you can't see without seeing every possible dimension of space-time continuum. you know, there is that. I know we can't. But you do have lobbying, and now if you're Obama, and rather or not you agree with him, let's say he has a very genuine plan, well, he has to sell himself out. They all have to sell themselves out, and that's no good, because then the line between where you should go after business and where you should go after government is not clear. The other thing I'm going to say is I think a lot of people on the right don't know how to be against the 1%, because one, they define it as people and not system, which that is not a common nuance. That's a nuance. And two, it is the case that when people get rich in capitalism, they increase the quality of life for everyone else. Because if I create Apple and get rich, I had to have created a product. But in a banktocracy, it is not necessarily the case that one that gets rich necessarily trickles down, quote-unquote, to everyone else. But where is one and where is the other? How do you tell the difference? Well, that's the issue. It's hard to do now. And lastly, I'm going to say, if, in fact, the system that is so problematic that we're discussing does fail, does collapse, which we need it to in order to fix it, but we as a society don't have the creativity and the critical thinking to use that opportunity and jump on it, this thing that we're asking for is going to be not a very good thing at all. It's going to be a disaster. So the thing is, when you want change, which change is often needed, but you yourself, which our education system, we've talked many times in this program about the lack of creativity, when you don't have the capacities or you haven't been equipped with what is needed to make the most of the phase that arises after that change occurs, then it can be very bad. So I think not only do we need to be working for the systematic change, but we have to be equipping ourselves to be ready for when that change occurs, which requires more creative thought.
Well, I couldn't agree more that corporatism is the problem and the corporate corruption of government is the problem, and that government cannot be held blameless if you take the money. Then there you are. I also think that I know that change takes courage, and Americans often confuse confidence with courage. They're not exactly the same thing. And I think all change starts with being informed and educated, and we lead the world in military power, probably, at least certainly technically. I don't think by any stretch of the imagination do we lead the world educationally. We are so behind in so many areas, specifically math, science. And we do not appreciate the arts as the rest of the world does. So the house needs to be put in order by all levels of society, and we often talk about, you know, the middle class and so forth, but what about poor people? You know, we talk about the top 1%. What about the bottom 1%? I mean, there's just so much left out of the conversation. But I do think it starts with, and I think we've all at some level agreed with this today, that it's the corporatism that has taken on a life of its own since FDR's death, in my opinion, and that now its hold on the American government is also its power over the American people. And that requires an enormous amount of courage because it's an enormous systematic change, as we've all been saying.
Thank you for continuing to listen, support, and share The Reasonable Voice with your friends. We are now accepting offers for your company or organization to advertise with us, and welcome new sponsors for The Reasonable Voice. To apply, please email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com.
Thank you for joining us today and every day, and recommending us to all your friends, both online and offline. And please download our downloadable podcasts. I am Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.